Bon, qui ne connaît pas Andrew King? Impossible, comme co-auteur du livre Auditore Neuroscience. Donc c'est, son nom vous est sans doute à tous très familier. Andrew King est neurophysiologiste. Il a travaillé dans un premier temps à King's College en physiologie, puis a fait son PhD dans le département de physiologie, donc toujours à King's College à Londres. Et aujourd'hui, il travaille à l'université d'Oxford. Ses travaux portent principalement sur le problème de la plasticité, de l'adaptation au signal et sur les bases neurophysiologiques de la perception multisensorielle. Alors aujourd'hui, il a le titre de son exposé, de sa conférence, sera, donc, comme je vous l'ai dit, portera donc sur les problèmes d'adaptation du cerveau et l'aptitude donc à changer en fonction de l'environnement auditif. And thanks to be with us. It's really a great pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much for the introduction. So hopefully everybody will be able to understand me. Please don't hesitate to say if you don't follow or if you have any questions. Now, as with any sensory system, there are a number of key functions, a number of key tasks that the auditory system has to be able to perform, which are sort of summarized here. Perhaps foremost among them is the ability to identify sounds of interest, in this case, to be able to pick out and recognize certain speech sounds and associate them with the individuals. And very often when we're doing this, it's not a situation like this where my voice is coming to you in a fair against a background of very little in the way of other sounds, but more commonly we have to understand to be able to perceive sounds of interest against a background of other sounds. And another major task that the auditory system face, in addition to being able to discriminate, identify and recognize those sounds, is to be able to tell them apart in terms of where they're located in space. In other words, to be able to identify where the approaching police car is coming from so that you don't step out into the road in front of it. Now, critical to all of these functions, and again, this is not unique to the auditory system, but in some ways is a particular challenge for the auditory system, is the capacity of the brain to adapt to changes in the inputs that reach the ears. So what do I mean by that? And this is really where the title for my lecture comes from, that we have to deal with the changing auditory world. Let's take the example of speech recognition. I'm going to play you a segment of speech. Let me just do that to start off with.
40s Viking Southward Sarah, silly automatic, becoming cyclonic, good.
Now that seems like a random collection of words, but it's actually taken from something called the shipping forecast, which is something that the BBC broadcasts every day as an indication of the weather conditions around the seas that surround the British Isles. So that was referring to specific areas within the sea around different parts of the British Isles and talking about the prevailing weather conditions. Now, let me just play that again. So it's not supposed to make a great deal of sense.
40s Viking Southward Sarah, silly automatic, becoming cyclonic, good.
So you can pick up elements of the weather in that. Now, if we do the same thing,
40s Viking Southward Sarah, silly automatic, becoming cyclonic, good.
So that was exactly the same speech, but now in the presence of background noise. And of course I can increase the noise level further, and eventually this will mask the speech sounds, making it much harder to pick them out and to understand what was being said. Now, essentially, what happens when we add noise, as in this, in the lower example, in the second example, is illustrated schematically over here on the right. By adding a second source of sound, adding noise to the sounds of interest, the speech sounds, we're increasing the overall level, the overall intensity of the sound, but more importantly, we're reducing the range of sound levels that are present. So the noise essentially fills in the gaps. So the blue trace shows the range of sound intensities that were present in the second example relative to the red trace, where we have a larger range of sound intensities. What that means is that the contrast of the sound is reduced in the presence of noise. Now, of course, we're encountering this all the time. In this room, the contrast of my voice is high. If I was to go out into the street and try to give the same lecture, the contrast would be much lower. So there's a major challenge for the auditory system to deal with this, to compensate for these changes. Now, one way in which this might happen, indeed it will be a very efficient way of dealing with this, would be to adjust, to change the range of sound intensities that neurons within the brain are sensitive to. In other words, to change their dynamic range. And that's essentially illustrated here. So this is the range of sound intensities going from very quiet to very loud. And in this case, we're looking at the firing rate of a hypothetical neuron in the brain as a function of sound intensity. In the case of the blue trace, the slope is greater. In other words, the gain has increased. And that means, in this case, the neuron would be more sensitive to small changes in sound intensity. And that's what would be useful to have in the low contrast signal in the presence of noise. Now, to determine whether the brain actually does this, the brain operates in this fashion, being able to continually adjust its sensitivity, this requires us to be able to record from neurons in the brain, which occasionally can be done in human patients, but not very often, and therefore more frequently has to be done in experimental animals. And this is an example of the sort of recording that one can obtain. This is a standard approach for characterizing the so-called spectrotemporal receptive field, the frequency tuning of a neuron in the brain. So in this case, this might be a recording in the auditory cortex, so measuring extracellularly the action potentials generated by that neuron. And if we think it's a neuron that responds to sound, we can then present different sounds, change the values of the sound in various ways, and look at what happens to the number of action potentials evoked, to the firing, to the response of the neuron. A more usual way of doing this, a better way of characterizing the tuning properties of the neuron, however, is to present a stimulus like this, where each of these little colored dots represents the amplitude, the intensity, of a different tone frequency changing over time. This is known as a random chord stimulus. And the advantage of doing this is, and then recording from the neurons, is that we can then obtain an unbiased measure of the tuning of the neurons. So we look at whenever an action potential occurs, what was the stimulus that immediately preceded that? And by averaging that stimulus, we build up a picture of the tuning of the neurons. So what the color blobs here show are the sound frequencies and time lags that evoke a change in the firing of the neuron. So in this case, this neuron is tuned, gives an excitatory response to this range of frequencies. Now that tuning originates in the cochlea, but is adjusted as we go up into the brain as a result of the interactions between different nerve cells and the way nerve cells converge onto the next level of the auditory pathway. Now, this so-called reverse correlation approach to extract the tuning properties of neurons in the brain provides us with a linear estimate of the receptive field of the neuron. But if we look at the output of that linear filter in terms of changing the intensity and looking at the effects on the firing rate, we generally find that there is a sigmoidal, a non-linear relationship. So if we want to characterize, if we want to model the responses of neurons in the brain, it's usually necessary to combine linear and non-linear models. So that's how we assess how the tuning of neurons in the brain. Now what happens when we change the contrast? Now this looks very busy, it looks horrible, but there's two key messages here. We're taking the same type of stimulus I showed you on the previous slide and changing its contrast. So this is a high contrast stimulus, lots of bright colors, meaning the range of sound intensities changes over a large range. And this is a low contrast stimulus, much less bright colors, indicating that the sound level range is much lower. And as we change the contrast of these stimuli and use them to measure the tuning of the neurons, what we find is that the receptive field doesn't change. It's the same. So here's a real spectrotemporal receptive field equivalent to the schematic I had on the previous slide. What does change, however, is the slope of this nonlinearity, the gain of the neurons. So when the contrast is high, as is currently the case in this room with my voice, the neurons are relatively insensitive to changes in intensity. But when the contrast is low, if we add in lots of noise, they become more sensitive to small changes. So this is a very efficient way of subtracting out the background noise. Now, this capacity of neurons to rapidly change their sensitivity is actually seen throughout the auditory pathway. So here's a textbook view of the auditory pathway. The cochlea would be down here. The auditory nerve enters the brainstem, then up to the midbrain, the thalamus, and the cortex. And if we measure the response properties of neurons at different levels, what we find is that the amount of adaptation, the changes in gain that we see, to changes in the overall noise level, the overall level of the stimulus, or the contrast of the stimulus, gradually increases from the auditory nerve, shown in green, up through the brain to the cortex. So this is more adaptation is shown on as we go to the right here. So this is something which emerges in the cortex. And this capacity to adapt to the overall level of a sound, the overall intensity, and to changes in the contrast of the sound enables representations of ecologically relevant sounds, such as speech, to be constructed within the cortex that are robust to the presence of noise. So this is a very efficient way of dealing with these rapid changes as we move from one acoustical environment to another. Now, this dynamic processing, which is going on all the time, also affects other aspects of auditory processing. One of them, as I mentioned at the start, is how we localize a sound in space. This is a very important function, particularly for picking out sounds of interest when there are multiple speakers present at the same time. But the process of localizing a sound presents a particular challenge which is not seen in other sensory systems. In the eye, for example, a representation of the visual world is projected onto the retina at the back of the eye. So each of the neurons there samples a tiny portion of the visual field. And by maintaining their connections into the brain, this automatically constructs a map of the visual world. That's not the case in the auditory system because, of course, the cochlea extracts the frequency of the sound, not its location. So to determine the direction, the whereabouts of a sound in space, the brain has to use physical cues, which are generated by the way a sound, so emanating from a source over here, interacts with the left and the right ear. In the case of this particular example, where the sound is located, say, to the left, to one side of the head, the sound will arrive at this ear, the left ear, before the right ear, so there is a difference in the time of arrival. Also, because the head is a dense medium, the sound may be shadowed, may be attenuated by the presence of the head, and therefore the amplitude of the sound at the far ear is reduced because it's reflected off the head. So we have another cue for determining the direction of the sound, that is the difference in the amplitude of the sound between the two ears. So these are the standard binaural cues, two-eared cues, which we use to localize sounds in space. Now, human listeners are very good at detecting tiny differences in the time of arrival or the amplitude of the sound between the two ears. And we can measure how good they are by playing sounds over headphones and having the sound, for example, slightly louder in one ear than the other ear. And the task given to an individual like this is to say whether the sound is on the left or on the right. So we end up with a so-called psychometric function, plotting the performance of a listener as a function of the difference in the intensity of the sound, the level of the sound between the two ears. And the slope of this function is a measure of how good they are at detecting a change in the intraoral time or the intraoral level difference, as the case may be. Now, you might think that if we were to do this for everyone in this room, we would end up with a range of values. But if we were to re-measure your ability to detect a change in the intensity or the change in the timing of the sound between the two ears, it would be very much the same as we make repeated measurements, that this property is fixed. It's not. It changes all the time. Let me show you how we can illustrate that. Taking an example like this of presenting sounds over headphones. And what we did in this particular experiment was to have human listeners wearing headphones. They were presented with noise bursts, very short segments of noise over the two headphones. They weren't asked to do any task. They simply were listening to this noise. And what was key to the statistics of the noise is that we were changing the intraoral level difference, the difference in the intensity between the two ears, over a particular distribution. So in this case, we could have a large range of intraoral level differences down to a very small range, essentially meaning a large range of spatial locations contracting down to a very small range. Now, after listening to this for a few seconds, we then measured their sensitivity to this particular cue, as I showed you on the previous slide. And what we find is that these so-called psychometric functions indicating how sensitive the listeners are to these cues change as a result of this passive listening. If we have a narrow distribution, a low variance in the range of intraoral level differences, the psychometric functions become steeper. In other words, the listeners become better at discriminating intraoral level differences. Similarly, if we record from neurons in the brain, in this case it happens to be the midbrain, and so we're looking at the response of one neuron, its firing rate as a function of intraoral level difference, and we do exactly the same thing. The gain of this neuron, the slope of this function, increases for a small range of intraoral level differences. In other words, both individual neurons and our human listeners are becoming more sensitive to a smaller range of intraoral level differences, which is a very efficient thing to do. I've shown you examples of how the sensitivity of neurons can change in two different ways, but it's a change in the gain in the sensitivity. But we can also see changes in the range of sound parameter values to which the neurons respond, a change in their tuning properties. Doing the same sort of experiment, that is presenting sounds over headphones the subjects listen to passively, But this time, we're keeping the range of values the same, but the mean of this distribution is changing. So it's going from 0, which will be in front, to the left or to the right. And what we then find is that the psychometric functions shift leftwards or rightwards, as the case may be. So once again, it's keeping the range of maximum sensitivity where the stimulus values are most likely to occur. Similarly, neurons in the brain do exactly the same thing. Their firing rate, interval level difference functions shift to the left or the right according to the mean of the stimulus distribution. So this emphasizes that the auditory system is changing all the time dynamically to process information in an efficient way to allow us to deal with constantly changing sound environments. But we can also see changes over a longer time course. This capacity to update, to change in response to the immediate past experience, what I've been talking about so far, extends through into the longer term, that the brain changes in response to altered experience, because of course that is the basis for learning language, that is the basis for improving musical skills as a result of experience of listening to or using particular types of sound. But this longer term plasticity, because now we can use the word plasticity as opposed to simply rapid dynamic changes that take place over the course of a few tens of milliseconds. Now we're talking about changes that extend through, of course, to days, weeks, or even years. But this capacity to adapt to changes in the sounds that are being presented is also extremely important for two other things. And that's essentially what I'm going to talk about for the rest of this lecture. It's critical for the way in which the brain develops, and it also offers the potential for adapting to hearing loss at different stages of life. Why would it be critical for development? Let's stay with the example of sound localization, that you localize a sound by comparing tiny differences in the signals reaching the two ears. In a newborn infant, the head is, of course, much smaller than in an adult. So the physical cues corresponding to a particular direction in space, the difference in the time of arrival, the difference in the amplitude of the sound, will be quite different in a young individual than in an adult. And during the course of development, as the head grows, those cue values, the relationship between those cues and directions in space, will be continually changing. Moreover, in adulthood, if we were to measure the size of the head of everybody in this room, there will be slight differences. So the physical cues that you individually have to localize with will be different from your neighbor. So this implies that during the course of development, you have to learn by experience to localize with your own ears. Well, we can demonstrate whether that is the case by experimentally altering those cues in a controlled and reversible fashion. Now, of course, that would be hard to do in human listeners, so these are experiments that, at least initially, are carried out on animals. Now, the experimental animal that we use is the ferret, which is illustrated here. This is the animal doing a behavioral task. One of the reasons why we use ferrets is that they're very curious animals, very easy to train. What's happening here is the animal has been trained to approach and stand on this platform. He licks a spout. That triggers this burst of noise that you just heard. That's the stimulus. And he will very naturally turn toward and approach the source of the sound. There are 12 loudspeakers located all the way around this apparatus, and the animal is rewarded for making the correct choice. Now, if we look at the performance of an animal by plotting the stimulus location versus the response the animal makes, you can see that the data line up nicely on the diagonal, indicating that they're doing this task pretty accurately. So when the sound comes from 90 degrees to the right, the animal will tend to go to 90 degrees to the right. This is a task which involves localizing sounds in the horizontal plane. It relies upon two ears, the binaural cues I told you about before. So if we introduce an earplug, the sort of thing you can buy from a drugstore, or that you, if you fly business class on a plane, you'll be provided with earplugs. It's exactly the same thing. We fit earplugs to the animals, and because this changes the two ear cues, the binaural cues, it will attenuate and delay the sound at this ear, so both the intraoral timing and intraoral intensity differences have changed. Now the animal makes lots of mistakes, and so the distribution of points is much more scattered. However, if we start this off in a young animal, and another reason for using a ferret for this study is they don't begin to hear until about 4 weeks after birth. So if we raise them from the onset of hearing with this unilateral hearing loss, with a partial hearing loss in one ear, allow them to grow up, and then train and test them as adults, hopefully you'll agree that they're actually doing pretty well, much like the controls. In other words, the developing auditory system has compensated for this hearing loss. These measurements were carried out with the earplug in place. The brain has adapted to the hearing loss in one ear. And the hearing loss is quite substantial. It's about 40 decibels. Now, if we take data like this and combine all the data from the different response locations and come up with an overall percentage correct score, for adult controls, this is the sort of thing that we see. It depends, the actual score you get depends on the type of sound, the duration of the sound, and so on. But these are fairly short bursts of broadband noise. Each dot represents a different animal, so this is the performance of an adult control. It's what, about 70% correct, I guess. If we take those animals, introduce an earplug into one ear, a hearing loss in one ear, the performance goes down, as was illustrated on the last slide. But in animals that have been raised with one ear plugged, we find they do much better. Not quite as well as the adult controls, so the adaptation is not complete, but they're doing substantially better than the adult animals the control animals receiving an earplug. So the brain has adapted to this asymmetry in inputs between the two ears. Now, when we take the earplug out of these animals and test them immediately, what we find is this: they perform just as well as the adult controls. That's actually a very surprising result. If the brain is able to adapt to alter binaural cues, to this very large attenuation in inputs in one ear, by retuning the neurons in the brain that respond to those cues, we would then expect that if we restore normal inputs, taking the earplug out, that the animals would then mislocalize in the opposite direction. But clearly they don't. So there's something else going on here. Now, the textbook view of how we localize sounds in space is what I've said so far, that you have two ears, you're comparing the timing or the intensity of the sound between the two ears. But there's another cue. There's another cue which is very often overlooked. The external ear, the outer ear, the part of the ear that you can actually see on the side of the head, is not simply there to support your glasses. It provides additional information that helps us to localize a sound in space. And this is because sounds coming from different directions are filtered by the physical properties, which are determined by the morphology, the size and shape of the outer ear, generating what are known as spectral cues. Now, what I mean by that is that if we play an identical sound from three different locations and then record with a tiny microphone, in the ear canal, how the amplitude varies with frequency, this is the sort of thing we might see. So these are actually real recordings from a human ear. It's exactly the same sound, but the direction is different in each case. Now, we don't hear these three sounds as being different. They sound exactly the same, but the spectrum, the variation in amplitude across frequency reaching the eardrum is different, and the brain is able to use that information to infer where a sound is in space. Now, as depicted here, going from up to down here, these cues are usually thought to provide the basis for vertical localization, and they certainly do. But as I'll show you, they also play a really important role in horizontal localization in this plane as well. So one possibility is that adaptation to a hearing loss in one ear actually involves learning to use these cues much more than would normally be the case. Now, to show whether or not that is the case, we can take advantage of the fact that in order to infer spatial information from these cues, the brain is comparing the amount of energy at different sound frequency components. For the data I've shown you so far, the stimulus was a burst of broadband noise, the sound that you heard. And what we had done was to digitally flatten the output of each of our 12 loudspeakers so that they were all the same. If, however, the property of the sound itself has peaks and troughs like this, which of course many real sounds do, the amplitude changes, varies at different frequencies, then that will make these cues unreliable because the brain is no longer able to tell whether the spectral patterns, the variations in amplitude, are properties of the sound itself or the way that the ear has filtered the sound. So what we're doing here is switching to a different stimulus. It's still a broadband stimulus, contains lots of frequencies, but now we're dividing it up into narrow frequency bands and either reducing or increasing the amplitude in each of those bands. We're randomizing the spectrum. So we're going from one trial to another, and the black line here will be different from each trial. In fact, the gray lines in the background just show you many iterations of this superimposed. Same animals doing the same task, and what we now find is that the performance of the animals that have adapted to a hearing loss in one ear now declines as we increase these variations in amplitude, as we increase the randomization of the spectrum, and therefore make these cues spatially unreliable. So this does suggest they are using spectral cues. The interesting thing, however, is that when we take the earplug out of the same animals and retest them, it has no effect. And when we put the earplug back in, same animals, once again, we see this dependence upon the spectrum. It's as if the brain is switching between different mechanisms for localizing sound based on binaural inputs or based on these spectral cues. Now, in addition to degrading the performance of the animals, impairing their ability to localize sound after they've adapted to a unilateral hearing loss, introducing these spectral changes also makes them respond in particular directions. So we have 12 loudspeakers, stimuli like this are being presented from each of them, and what we can do is that whenever the animal went to one particular position, say this one 30 degrees, we then average the stimulus. What was the stimulus that made the animal go to this direction? In order to see whether there's anything about these spectral patterns that influences their localization. Now, if we do this in normal controls, the answer is there's nothing there, or very little anyway. So what we're looking at here is the response to each of the 12 loudspeaker positions, and this is the average spectrum of the sound beforehand. There's nothing there. So those are in normal controls. However, in the animals that have adapted to hearing loss, There are, what now emerges from this behavioral reverse correlation, so it's a behavioral equivalent of what I started with, talking about how receptive field properties are measured in the brain. What we now see is that certain features, certain frequency components emerge that always precede an animal going to a particular direction. So in, for example, if the stimulus happens to contain a peak here at this high frequency, the animal is most likely to respond directly straight ahead. Now, the significance of this is that if these animals are relying more upon the spectral cues, we would expect this behavioral reverse correlation to reflect those spectral cues. So if we actually take the physical measurements, place a microphone in the ear canal, and measure the way in which the outer ear filters the sound, I hope you'll agree that these two look extremely similar. So these animals have adapted by using spectral cues, by changing, switching from binaural to a monaural mechanism of adaptation. Now, physiologically, very briefly on this, we see exactly the same thing in the responses of neurons in the brain. So we record from neurons in the cortex, we measure their sensitivity to all the different cues, and what we find is that they become relatively more sensitive to the spectral cues. So we have what's called what we're calling a weighting index here, which is simply a measure of how dependent each of the neural responses, individual neurons, is on the spectral cues provided by the non-occluded ear, the ear without the hearing loss, relative to all the other cues. And by making these measurements and introducing a virtual earplug, which mimics the actual earplug the animals were raised with, what we find is that in control animals in red, introducing this virtual earplug makes no difference. But in the animals that are previously adapted to the hearing loss, now the weighting index goes up, meaning that the neurons are also more dependent upon the spectral cues. So what we see is both physiological and behavioral evidence for cue re-weighting. But the fact that the brain can switch between different mechanisms for localizing sound is very efficient because it means that sound localization accuracy will be maintained, irrespective of the presence of a hearing loss or not. Now, that has considerable clinical implications for the design and fitting of hearing aids. These are pictures of different types of hearing aids. One of the commonest involves placing the microphone behind the ear, and then there's a little tube that goes into the ear canal. That is a terrible design because that will miss out the spectral cues provided by the outer ear. It is much better to have the microphone actually in the ear canal itself. So I think this type of work can point to potential improvements in the design of hearing aids and even eventually cochlear implants too, shown on the right. But you might say, well, the spectral cues, as I've demonstrated, depend on what the actual sound is. Therefore, they are potentially unreliable cues. So we were intrigued by whether there was another way in which the brain could adapt to unilateral hearing loss. So in order to address this, we changed from a broadband stimulus to a narrowband sound. It's not a pure tone, but it's close to it. It's a 1/6 octave noise burst. So there is no way the brain can use spectral cues here because there isn't enough bandwidth to do so, because that relies upon a comparison of the amplitude at different frequencies. And in the same animals I've been talking about, which adapted to a hearing loss in one ear during the course of development, when we now switch them to this narrowband sound, they perform less well, as we would expect, relative to a broadband sound. And in controls, if we introduce an earplug in one ear, then their performance is severely degraded, as we would expect, because at the center frequency of this stimulus that is chosen, they should be using exclusively intraoral intensity differences, and the earplug changes the intensity in one ear. But in animals that have adapted to an earplug, we see it's pretty noisy, but substantially better performance than the controls. So the plasticity is also there for narrowband sounds. And we see plasticity again at the level of neurons in the brain. So these are again, in fact, the same recordings done at the same time in the cortex, but now measuring the sensitivity of neurons to intraoral level differences. Often what happens is that as we change the intraoral level difference, the firing rate will go up, and the neurons generally prefer sounds that are louder in the opposite ear. So if we're recording in the left side of the brain, they'll prefer sounds that are louder in the right ear. So that's shown over here. So the slope is positive for neurons recorded in the left side of the brain. The slope is negative for neurons recorded in the right side of the brain, because the functions will be going like that. Now, if we introduce a hearing loss in one ear during the course of these recordings to control animals, this sensitivity to this binaural cue disappears completely. The slopes fall virtually to zero. However, in animals that have been raised and adapted to hearing loss in one ear, what we find is that they retain their sensitivity to intraoral level differences, but in both the left and the right sides of the brain, they now prefer sounds that are louder in the right ear. That is the ear, the non-occluded ear. These animals were raised with a hearing loss in the left ear. Similarly, if we look at how inputs from the two ears interact to and plot what are known as binaural interaction functions, this is all the data recorded from the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. So these are the binaural interaction functions which peak just to the left or the right of the midline. But in animals that have adapted to an earplug behaviorally, to a hearing loss in one ear behaviorally, these binaural interaction functions shift toward the right, and that is in the direction for adaptation. So, just to summarize this before I go on to the last part, what we see during the course of development is that the brain is able to compensate for changes in the inputs reaching the ears. We're looking at this with the example of a hearing loss in one ear. We have, of course, looked at the effects of varying that hearing loss between the two ears, but this is the example in which we can show how the brain reacts to a unilateral hearing loss. These animals were raised with this, and the way in which we did this was to have them wearing an earplug about 80% of the time, and for the rest of the time they had normal hearing, and that was done because middle ear disease in human children, which affects 80 to 90% of infants up to the age of 5, typically involves recurring periods of hearing loss that oscillate between the two ears. So we're trying to look at something which is similar to that, but in a much more controlled fashion. And what we find is that the brain can adapt to compensate for this, but intriguingly, it does so in two different ways. We have a series of cues for localizing sound, and the brain can essentially learn to ignore those cues which have been changed, altered by the hearing loss. That is in the form of a reweighting of spatial cues. Or the brain can adapt to the altered cues, in this case, the altered binaural cues. So having these two mechanisms which appear, we can actually detect according to what type of sound is used, really emphasizes how adaptable the developing brain is. Now, it makes sense that this plasticity should be there during development, because that's when the head is growing, the ears are growing, the distance between the ears is increasing, and therefore the cues are changing. But it turns out the adult brain is just as adaptable. Maybe not quite as much, it's hard to say whether it's more or less. But what we've done, and what now we're switching to human listeners, is to look at the effects of the same type of temporary reversible hearing loss in one ear. We put together an experimental setup that was as close as possible to that used for the ferrets to measure the ability of our listeners to localize sound in the horizontal plane. And what we find is that when we introduce an earplug in one ear, their localization accuracy goes down. But if we leave the earplug in place, over the course of about a week, in this case over 9 days, they gradually get better. They're gradually recovering. So what we see is this rapid adaptation to unilateral hearing loss in adult listeners. Now, just as in the ferrets, when we take the earplug out, their performance is just the same as it was before the earplug was introduced, implying that they're doing this by reweighting different cues. And indeed, we confirm that by switching between different stimuli, as I showed you before, either spectrally flat noise where the spectral cues were available, or by randomizing the spectrum of our stimulus to remove those spectral cues. And if we do this, if we remove the spectral cues, they don't learn. And these are the same individuals who were learning on this stimulus. We're just interleaving, mixing up the stimuli. But it turns out that there is an even greater similarity between what is happening to us all the time as hearing conditions change to the developmental studies in the ferrets. Because the auditory system is not only able to deal with an asymmetry between the ears by reweighting different cues continuously, but it can also do so by remapping, by changing sensitivity to the autobinaural cues as well. So this is a more recent study in which we use the same setup to look at the effects of a temporary hearing loss in one ear on the ability of the individuals to localize sound. In this case, it really was very temporary. In the previous slide, our subjects wore an earplug for most of the day for about 7 days or so. In this case, the earplug was only present during the behavioral testing session. And they performed 800 trials in this session. The earplug was taken out, they went away, they came back usually a few days later, wore another earplug, and we measured their performance again. And despite the fact the duration of the hearing loss was much shorter, what we found was this intensive training over the course of, in this case, 7 different sessions spaced over 2 to 3 weeks led to a significant improvement in performance. So they're adapting just during the behavioral testing sessions. Again, this depends on the stimulus, so it needs spectral cues, so the flat noise stimulus. It doesn't work if we scramble the spectral cues. But the same subjects also adapt to narrowband sounds. So in exactly the same testing sessions, we interleave, in this case, pure tones, which you can only localize using binaural cues, depending on the frequency, a difference in the timing or the intensity of the sound between the two ears. So the first session here for one individual, 2 different frequencies, which were chosen because this is where we use intraoral time differences, this is where we use differences in the intensity between the two ears, and then the last of the training sessions, you can see they've substantially improved. And indeed, that's sort of quantified here by determining what the size of the error is in their localization judgments, and this steadily goes down for the different frequencies. So with this intensive period of training, just wearing an earplug for a few hours every few days, the auditory brain is able to adapt by reweighting different cues and by remapping different cues. These two processes of adaptation, shown in the different lines, different colored lines here, follow the same time course, but they actually appear to involve independent mechanisms. If we look at how much remapping, that is adaptation to the autobinaural cues, we see for individual subjects, each dot is a different listener, and how much reweighting we see, they're not related at all. And the remapping is about the same for different sound frequencies, indicating it's there for intraoral time and intraoral level differences, but the reweighting is only seen for high frequencies because that's where you have spectral cues. Now, actually, we see the same thing in the cortical physiology data from our experimental animals because if we compare the amount of remapping and reweighting, they're unrelated and have the same frequency dependence. So the brain is able to use these two mechanisms independently. The final thing I want to show you is that this plasticity we see here, which is entirely driven by behavioral training, doing the localization task in the presence of the altered inputs, in the presence of a temporary hearing loss. This requires the cortex. I've shown you that with the physiology data before that we see equivalent changes in the cortex to that seen behaviorally, but that's simply a correlation. What we need to be able to show in order to highlight where to really look for training-dependent plasticity is to demonstrate that the cortex is critical for this. So this means going back to the animal studies. Here is a ferret, same task, so I won't show the video again. This animal is actually scoring 100% correct, sort of model animal. Introducing an earplug into one ear, performance degrades. So this is an animal that was normally raised. And if we leave the earplug in place, what we find is that the performance gradually improves, just like the human listeners. And the rate at which that performance improves, the rate of plasticity, the rate of recovery, is determined entirely by the frequency of training. So this group of animals were trained every day, this group every 6 days. They did the same number of trials overall, but it's concentrating the training into a narrow period, which really drives the plasticity. The cortex is essential for this. This is an experimental approach for silencing neurons in the cortex. This involves the introduction of a light-sensitive protein. This is a technique that I imagine some of you will be familiar with. This is a technique of optogenetics. So the green region here represents the injection site. We can confirm with a recording electrode that when this region of the brain is illuminated with a laser, that the activity of the neurons is reduced compared to the period when the laser is not being turned on. And what we find is that when we can silence auditory cortical neurons in this fashion, this has no effect on the ability of the animals to localize sound, but does impair their ability to learn, to adapt with training to hearing loss. So it's the cortex that matters. And indeed, the same animals, when there is no laser, because it's the laser that activates the protein and silences the neurons, so the same animals without laser illumination do adapt, and in fact adapt just as well as controls. Now, the final piece of data is that we think of the auditory cortex as the key region that enables us to adapt, to change in response to past experience. Most work on the effects of musical training and so forth has focused on the cortex. This is plasticity in response to altered inputs, as opposed to simply using the same sound in the form of musical training. Nevertheless, it's training again that is critical to driving these changes and to any potential use of this in a clinical context. But the cortex doesn't work in isolation. This is a highly simplified schematic of the auditory pathway going from the cochlea through the brainstem, midbrain, thalamus, and cortex. And I've simply put this here because the black lines show the connections that gradually go up through the system, leading up to and finishing in the cortex, whereas the red lines are those that come back down again. In other words, the cortex is connected to the thalamus, the cortex again projects to the midbrain and down to the brainstem. And we know very little about these descending projections. But there is recent growing evidence that the improved auditory skills, speech processing skills of musicians, actually involves and is based on an interplay between the cortex and subcortical levels. And in particular, people like Claude Alain and Nina Krauss would argue that top-down signals are coming from the cortex to influence processing at subcortical levels. That's hard to get at in human listeners, but this picture, which you saw a couple of slides ago, where we've introduced this light-sensitive protein into the cortex, it's green because the viral vector that's used here contains something called green fluorescent protein. And this will be transported along the axons of the neurons here. So the cell bodies are here. Their axons terminate in the thalamus and indeed down in the midbrain. So these are all from this injection. And we showed some years ago that the descending projection from the auditory cortex to the midbrain is critical for spatial learning. Using another technique involving lasers, we were able to selectively remove the projection from the cortex to the midbrain. And now, if we look at the ability of the animals to adapt to an earplug to a hearing loss in one ear, that is lost. So it seems to be the descending outputs from the cortex talking to subcortical levels, which is critical for this. So just to sort of summarize all this, I've showed you a number of examples of how the response properties of neurons in the brain are continually updating, changing, depending upon the recent history of sounds, depending upon, if you like, the statistics of the auditory world. In some cases, those changes simply involve a change in the gain in the sensitivity of the neurons. In other cases, it's a change in the tuning properties of the neurons. And these are going on all the time. They're rapidly changing from one thing to another, which makes for a very efficient way of processing information in rapidly changing environments. But we also see these adaptive changes over a longer time period, and what I focus on here is adaptation to altered inputs associated with hearing loss. We particularly see this during development, but it's also seen in the adult brain, and at least in adults, and it may well be that this is true during development as well. What is critical in driving these adaptive effects is behavioral training, is engaging with a task. And we've isolated some of the mechanisms involved in terms of how the brain does this, and we're beginning to look at and unravel which circuits within the brain are critical for doing so. We know that the cortex plays fundamentally the key role, but it seems likely that it's the connections of the cortex to lower structures, to subcortical structures, that matters. And then perhaps finally, whilst we are interested in the basic science of hearing, the fact that we are looking at these adaptive changes using models of hearing loss has important implications for the rehabilitation of the hearing impaired. We can potentially target different training strategies to individuals depending upon the type of hearing loss in order to allow the brain to go some way towards compensating for this. And as I showed you earlier, this also has implications for hearing aid design. So just perhaps most importantly of all, to very briefly acknowledge the contributions of people in my group who did this. So the initial studies I talked about, changing contrast, this is Neera Binovitz, Ben Wilmore, and Jan Schnupp, and then moving into the effects of reversible hearing loss on the developing brain, Peter Keating, Johannes Dahmann, and Rob Campbell, and then moving that up into the adult brain, initially Oliver Kaselnik and Carl Parsons. The human studies were Dan Kumpik and Peter Keating, and then the experiments actually looking at the neural circuits involved, Fernando Nadal, Victoria Bajo, in collaboration with Ed Boyden at MIT. Okay, thank you.